Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. An attack in Afghanistan kills six NATO troops. A NATO spokesman has confirmed that a suicide bomber on a motorbike attacked a joint U.S.-Afghan patrol near Bagram Airfield, killing six NATO soldiers and wounding three others. Speaking with VOA's Ayaz Ghul just moments ago, revealed the attack itself goes beyond a body count.
It's interesting because that area north of Kabul is so secure and so sensitive. And this Bagram Air Base has been from the beginning under the U.S. control. And there has been quite the security has been really tight throughout these years. But this attack signifies and it shows the ability of the Taliban to reach anywhere they want to. And that's quite a setback for the security measures in that province, which is north of Kabul, the Parwan province.
Michael Lawhorn, a spokesman for NATO's Resolute Support Base in Kabul, told VOA that an investigation is underway into the midday blast. The base is the largest U.S. military facility in Afghanistan. In a social media post, the Taliban claimed at least 19 people were killed, mostly U.S. soldiers. An Afghan provincial official took the extraordinary step Sunday of imploring Kabul on Facebook to send help immediately, warning southern Helmand province was in danger of falling to the Taliban. Deputy Provincial Governor Mohammad Jan Rasul Yar said at least 90 Afghan security force personnel had been killed in 2 days of fighting. South Asia analyst Jonah Blank of the RAND Corporation told VOA's Victor Beatty the use of social media in such a way is not unprecedented in Afghanistan.
The former head of Afghan intelligence also took to Facebook recently to express his displeasure with the government's approach.
This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama expressed confidence those opposing the Islamic State group will prevail and said he thinks there will be significant progress in that effort by the time he leaves office. In an interview with NPR News released on Monday, Mr. Obama called Islamic State a virulent, nasty organization.
It is also important for us to keep things in perspective. And this is not an organization that can destroy the United States. This is not a huge industrial power. They can pose great risks to us institutionally or in a systematic way, but they can hurt us.
He stressed that the worst damage the militants could do would be if the United States were to change their way of life or to change their values. Iran is complaining that new U.S. travel restrictions on four countries, including Iran, violates the nuclear deal with six world powers. Visitors from 38 countries whose citizens do not need visas to come to the U.S. will now have to get one if they are also dual citizens from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Sudan. Now, as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said in a letter to Iranian Foreign Minister, that the United States will fully adhere to its commitments under the nuclear deal. The Ethics Committee of football's governing body, FIFA, has banned the embattled president, Sepp Blatter, and his one-time protege from the sport for 8 years. FIFA has been involved in scandal after 14 FIFA officials were arrested in Zurich in May and charged in the United States with nearly 50 counts of corruption. The ban will likely derail Mr. Plantini's bid to succeed Blatter when elections are held in February. And India's Supreme Court has rejected an appeal to keep a young man in prison. He was one of six males who brutally raped a young woman. The court said on Monday that under the present law, detention cannot be extended beyond 3 years. Sunil Madhok was a lawyer for the petitioners, and he told observers to the proceedings that there are only two provisions under law as far as juveniles are concerned. One is detention and the other is rehabilitation. As far as detention is concerned, the court is constrained because there's no clear legislative sanction in the absence of that juvenile cannot be detained. 23-year-old Jody Singh died of severe organ failure after suffering internal injuries and brain damage in the Savage Gang rape that took place in December of 2012. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In this festive season of Christmas and the New Year, and that's why it's very important to remind people that the human values are being targeted here and are under attack.
That's Babar Balouch of the UN Refugee Agency. He says the UNHCR and other agencies are calling on Hungary to end the xenophobic campaign against migrants and refugees. Details coming up. Also in the news, Burundi's parliament is debating the prospect of having an African Union peacekeeping force in the country. And Rwandan President Paul Kagame has praised the outcome of last week's constitutional referendum, which allows him to seek re-election possibly three more times. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi's parliament is debating the prospect of having an African Union peacekeeping force in the country. Last week, the presidential spokesman said an AU force would violate the country's sovereignty. The AU's Peace and Security Council has approved sending 5,000 peacekeepers to Burundi. Officials said they do not need an invitation from the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. The AU force would be deployed for at least 6 months to protect civilians and create conditions for holding reconciliation talks. The government of Uganda says it will resume mediating the talks for Burundi on December 28th. Both the government and the country's largest opposition coalition welcomed the move to restart talks. Rwandan President Paul Kagame has praised the outcome of last week's constitutional referendum. It allows him to seek re-election possibly three more times. Election officials say the term limit change was approved by 98% of the voters. However, Mr. Kagame did not say whether he actually would seek another term. Before the referendum, he was due to step down in 2017 after serving two terms. The change allows him to seek another seven-year term in office, and if successful, to run for 2 5-year terms after that. The U.S. and the EU have criticized the constitutional changes, saying they undermine democracy. They've urged Mr. Kagame not to seek re-election. UN and European agencies are criticizing Hungary for waging what they call a xenophobic campaign against migrants and refugees. An ad campaign describes them as criminals and terrorists. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, the Council of Europe, and the Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights are calling on Hungarian leaders to adopt a true spirit of humanity. Babar Balouch is a spokesman for UNHCR. From the Hungarian capital Budapest, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
What we are worried about is this new officially launched media campaign and a new blast of rhetoric that the Hungarian politicians, or at least the leaders who are in charge of the government over here, have started since the beginning of December. It's a media campaign which equates refugees, people who are fleeing war and conflict, to be portrayed as criminals, invaders, and all other things that refugees are not. I mean, refugees are people who are actually fleeing from fear. And this rhetoric is just being put out every day to the Hungarian public, which fuels intolerance, fear, and also xenophobia against refugees and migrants.
Are you seeing these campaigns on radio, TV, and newspapers, for example?
They're all around. Billboards, on social media, on TV, advertisements in the newspapers. It's a deliberate attempt to attack people's sympathy in this festive season of Christmas and the New Year. And that's why it's very important to remind people that the human values are being targeted here and are under attack. I mean, this is a season which should remind us more about humanity, not going against it.
Would you give us an update on the migrant and refugee situation in Hungary?
Currently, there's a trickle that keeps arriving in the country. The number is in tens, 30s, 40s that arrive every day. Everyone who arrives here, refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, they're all arrested by the police, put in detention, produced in front of a judge quickly, and then given orders to be expelled back to Serbia. The issue is that Serbia is not taking people back. So currently we have around 700 people who are stuck in limbo in detention.
And what can be done about that?
The policies need to change here. The policies need to conform with those that are applicable internationally. The policies need to be put in line with the European principles and European values as well. I mean, seeking asylum or seeking refuge is not a crime. So why should these people suffer who have been already through so much of trauma and loss?
Are you seeing similar campaigns in any other country?
I think some of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe, we are worried about it, but the level that the Hungarian government has taken, it just brings everything to a new low. It's a blow on humanity and also on the European values.
Considering the numbers you mentioned, maybe 40 people a day coming into Hungary, it seems like such a small number to trigger such a campaign.
Indeed, and this is not happening for the first time. Back in June, the Hungarian government started an anti-migrant campaign for the Hungarian public over here. There were huge billboards put up in Budapest and other parts of the country. So the government has been officially doing it from time to time. And the number coming over here in terms of asylum seekers or those who need international protection are low because Hungary has put up a fence with its border with Serbia and also has a fence on its border with Croatia. So it has fenced down itself completely.
Do you know the health condition of the 700 people being held in Hungary?
My UNHCR colleagues try to visit them, try to counsel them. We try to make sure through partners that they have access to lawyers or legal assistants, interpreters. But these people are stuck in limbo. They just don't know, many of them, what's going to happen to them. And also with this, from the last few months, Hungarian official policies towards asylum seekers and refugees have also become very restrictive. So there's a less chance for people here to access a fair and an efficient asylum system.
Any idea how long some of them have been held?
Those that I have met from Afghanistan, Iran, and Syria have been there at least for 2 months that I spoke with.
Babar Baloush is a spokesman for UNHCR from Budapest. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa. The UN Refugee Agency reports two migrants drowned off the coast of Libya today as they tried to reach Italy. 10 others are missing and more than 100 were rescued. The French news agency says those who were rescued were taken to Tripoli. Also, a Turkish news agency says 18 refugees drowned Saturday when their boat sank off the southwest coast of Turkey. 14 others from Iraq, Pakistan, and Syria were rescued. Two smuggling suspects were arrested. UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson says more than 900,000 refugees and migrants have landed in Greece and Italy this year. Most have come from Syria. Three suicide bombers killed six civilians in northeast Nigeria yesterday. An army spokesman says three young bombers set off explosions in the town of Benchik as the military launched an attack on two nearby Boko Haram camps. The army spokesman says the bombers appeared to be between the ages of 10 and 14. The dead were members of a civilian joint task force who were manning a security checkpoint. 14 others were injured. In other news in Nigeria, General Tukur Buratai has announced the government is lifting the death sentences of 66 soldiers accused of mutiny last year. The army chief says their sentences will be reduced to 10 years in prison. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi's parliament is debating the prospect of having an African Union peacekeeping force in the country. And the Rwandan President Paul Kagame has praised the outcome of last week's constitutional referendum, which allows him to seek re-election, possibly three more times. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Human Rights Watch says at least 175 people and probably many more have been kidnapped in the Democratic Republic of Congo this year. The rights group has called for a special police unit to track kidnappers and investigate allegations of complicity by state agents. Reporter Nick Long has more from Rutshuru territory in eastern DRC, where nearly all the kidnappings have taken place.
Human Rights Watch says armed groups or former members of armed groups appear to have been responsible in many cases. Victims were usually released after ransoms had been paid. The rights group says it was told by an official the leader of one kidnapping gang could have been working with people in the military. That gang leader was put on trial in April, but his allegations of soldiers' complicity do not seem to have led to any judicial inquiry, and no other kidnappers have been tried since. VOA spoke to a kidnapped victim, aid worker Amboko Kitunguro, who was abducted last month along with 13 colleagues by about a dozen heavily armed men. It was an ordeal, he says. The kidnappers marched their victims through the forest from midday until 10:30 at night. He says the next day the kidnappers, who claimed to be from the Rwandan rebel FDLR group, took the exhausted aid workers who had had nothing to eat or drink back to a road and released them. A few minutes after we were released, says Kitungira, we met some government soldiers. They asked us, "Where have you come from?" he says. We told them we had been kidnapped, and they said, "Really? We were looking for you." The Congolese army reported its soldiers pursued these kidnappers and freed the hostages. But Kitungira said there was no pursuit and no shooting, even though the victims told the soldiers the kidnappers were just a few meters away. Asked if the soldiers' appearance at the moment of their release had been a coincidence, he said he could not comment. Local sources said a ransom was paid for the aid workers. UN mission spokesman Felix Bass told VOA the number of kidnappings has gone down since the United Nations and the Congolese army agreed on an anti-kidnapping strategy. One of the problems, he added, is that people are often tempted to pay ransoms, which does not help to reduce kidnapping. According to Human Rights Watch, at least four of the kidnapped victims this year were killed, and another has disappeared. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The United States is expected to add two species of lions in Africa to its endangered list today in a move that will make it more difficult for hunters to bring lion trophies back to the country. The Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages the list, is linking the move to declining populations in the wild and the need to ensure those who illegally hunt cannot gain from their actions. One lion species found in central and western parts of Africa, as well as India, has a population estimated around 1,000 and is being classified as endangered. The other species, predominantly in eastern and southern Africa, have a population of about 19,000 and will be classified as threatened as well. Genes play a role in the development of cancer, but a new study suggests that genetic bad luck, which predisposes us to cancer, may be less of an influence on our risk for the disease than environmental factors. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Genes are not destiny seems to be the message from a new study looking at the relative risk of environmental factors on the development of cancer. In fact, says Yusuf Hanoun, who heads the Stony Brook University Cancer Center in New York, bad genes and DNA mutations appear to play a relatively small role in whether someone develops cancer. More important, he says, are environmental exposures such as inhaling tobacco smoke and eating red meat.
Around 70 to 90% of cancer incidence appears to be related to external factors, whereas only 10 to 30% is related to those intrinsic factors I talked about with mutation rates, etc.
Hanoun and colleagues used a number of complex approaches, including computer modeling, population studies, and genetic analyses, to arrive at their conclusions published in the journal Nature. For example, they looked at how stem cells in different parts of the body divide and mutate, noting that a similar number of genetic errors did not lead to cancer in all tissues. The researchers also investigated how people's risk of cancer changes when they move from one place to another, suggesting a strong role for external factors in the development of cancer. A study published earlier this year in the journal Science concluded most cancer was the result of genetic bad luck, but this study arrives at an opposite conclusion. Hanoun, however, does not entirely rule out genetic randomness when it comes to who gets cancer and who doesn't.
So there is an element of luck in that, but then there is a larger element of exposures and external factors that increase that risk tremendously. So what we want to do is identify those and dial it back so we go back to that very low intrinsic level.
In the meantime, some big cancer risk factors like cigarette smoking are already known and can be avoided. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
While the U.S. and Cuba have cleared major hurdles on the path towards normalization, significant issues remain also. Some critics say the U.S. approach is unbalanced and could result in setbacks for the Cuban people. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
A year ago, the U.S. and Cuba publicly announced initial steps toward restoring diplomatic ties and normalizing relations. President Barack Obama.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba.
Over the past year, the two countries have reached several milestones, including the U.S. removal in May of Cuba's state sponsor of terrorism designation, as explained by then-State Department spokesman Jeff Rathke.
Cuba had not provided any support for international terrorism during the preceding 6 months.
Also, with pomp and ceremony, Cuba raised its flag to reopen its embassy in Washington in July. A reciprocal U.S. flag-raising ceremony took place in Havana in August. Some say it's too much too soon. University of Miami Latin America analyst Jose Azell spoke via Skype.
I think we have made a serious mistake by beginning going down a process without demanding concessions from Cuba.
The issues include concerns about Cuba's human rights record, its treatment of detainees, and a significant uptick in the number of Cubans immigrating to the U.S. in 2015. Azell says many of those Cubans are fleeing economic hardship.
Cubans are desperate. I mean, the illusion that Raul Castro was going to make some changes economically, at least, has now been totally shown to be false.
The U.S. and Cuba have launched working groups to address issues, including human rights concerns, as steps toward normalization. American University Latin American politics specialist William Leo Grand says the two sides still need to cross a couple of major hurdles.
The two really big issues that have to be resolved are the U.S. economic embargo, which is at the top of Cuba's list, and the U.S. presence at Guantanamo. The United States recognizes that Guantanamo is, in fact, sovereign Cuban territory, but we insist on the treaty that was signed in 1934 that gives the United States the right to lease the base in perpetuity.
Still, Leo Grant says he thinks U.S. normalization with Cuba will move faster than it has with some other countries because there's strong interest on both sides in completing the relationship. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
This past year, Africa saw elections, coup attempts, constitutional changes, and peaceful transfers of power from Burundi, which is still dealing with violence and unrest after its president decided to run for a third term, to Tanzania and Nigeria, which both saw peaceful transitions of power. It was a year of setbacks and gains for democracy on the continent. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig reports.
2015 was a year of ups and downs for democracies across Africa. Nigeria saw its first democratic transition of power in April, when former General Muhammadu Buhari defeated incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan. The polls ended 16 years of one-party dominance. In Tanzania, President Jakaya Kikwete stepped down after his constitutionally mandated two terms. John Magufuli was peacefully elected in October after a spirited campaign. And the former public works minister shoveled leaves and trash to mark Independence Day after canceling the usual festivities as part of efforts to abolish waste and reduce poverty. Benji Ndolo is the founder and director for the Organization for National Empowerment, ONE.
The new president, Magufuli, he's just started on a wonderful, wonderful note, full of energy, full of optimism, full of action, less talk. So this, again, is very heartening. Especially for countries like Kenya that are just next door, and for the region, Uganda goes to elections in about another month and a half.
Burkina Faso dodged a coup attempt in September and went on to elect the country's first new leader in 27 years. It was a successful end to the transition after mass protests ousted longtime president Blaise Compaoré in October 2014. Sociologist Fahiraman Rodrigue Kone from Ivory Coast.
Je dirais ce que nous pouvons voir et les enseignements que nous pourrons tirer.
He says what we see in terms of democratic progress is the rise of a responsible society, what he calls a society of citizens. He says the quality of the political offer also depends on demand, and that is the missing link that he says is emerging. But for these highlights, there were also lows. Burundi descended into chaos in April after President Pierre Nkurunziza made his bid for what critics say is an unconstitutional third term in office. After a May coup attempt, protesters taking to the streets, and bloody police crackdowns, Nkurunziza was re-elected in July under a haze of suspicion. Nearly 200,000 people have fled the country. The U.S. has put sanctions on at least four senior officials, both from the government and from the coup organizers, while the U.N. Security Council has condemned killings and torture. And still, the violence continues. As it has in South Sudan, where tens of thousands have been killed and more than 2 million forced to flee their homes since civil war flared up 2 years ago. Supporters of both President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar have accused each other of violating a ceasefire agreement. The peace deal called for an interim administration to be in place by late November, but these plans were delayed. The new target for a transitional government is mid-January. Protests turned violent in the Republic of Congo this past year as President Denis Sassou Nguesso held an October constitutional referendum to remove a two-term limit and the age ceiling of 70. He won with 92% of the vote, raising suspicion among international observers. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, President Joseph Kabila is accused of postponing the presidential election, originally set for November 2016, and attempting to amend term limits. Rwanda voted a resounding yes with 98.4% of the vote in a recent constitutional referendum to allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in 2017 and possibly two more after that. However, Eric Manga, a researcher at the University of Nairobi, thinks Africa would be better off building up institutions.
It is high time Africa should forget about this issue of laying their destiny with individuals. We know that we'll always have good ones and bad ones. You know, if you have stronger institutions, we will be in a position to take the right path.
2016 will be another test for African democracies, with key votes expected in at least nine countries. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports features and more coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi's parliament is debating the prospect of having an African Union peacekeeping force in the country. Rwandan President Paul Kagame has praised the outcome of last week's constitutional referendum, which allows him to seek re-election possibly three more times. And Human Rights Watch says at least 175 people and probably many more have been kidnapped in the Democratic Republic of Congo this year. Coming up, music from Angola. In our features segment, we focus on migrant workers. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny set of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand some big football bans kick off your sports report.
Yehias, the Ethics Committee of World Football's governing body, FIFA, has given eight-year bans to two of the most powerful men in the sport, embattled President Sepp Blatter and Frenchman Michel Platini. Lisa Schlein reports for the Voice of America from Geneva.
FIFA President Sepp Blatter was in a combative mood when he faced journalists shortly after he received word of his suspension by the Ethics Committee.
I'm sorry that I am, as president of FIFA, this punching ball, and I'm sorry for football. I regret that I'm this punching ball there. I regret for my organization that I have served with heart and conscience during 41 years, but specifically I regret, and I'm for all the members, the team members working in FIFA.
FIFA's Ethics Committee found Blatter and UEFA President Michel Platini guilty of ethics code breaches regarding an unauthorized payment of $2 million by the president of FIFA to Platini. Swiss prosecutors are conducting a criminal investigation into these allegedly illegal payments. Both men deny wrongdoing. Blatter says he thought he had convinced the panel of the tribunal that the FIFA payment to Platini was legitimate. He says the tribunal has accused him and Platini of lying, but it has proven nothing.
But something what is not true cannot be proven. And if it cannot be proven, cannot be guilty. I am now suspended 8 years. Suspended 8 years. But I will fight. I will fight for me and I will fight for FIFA.
Blatter says he will take his case to the FIFA Appeals Committee and the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Blatter has been FIFA president since 1998. He is supposed to step down on February 26th. If the eight-year suspension holds, Blatter notes he will not even be allowed to attend the Congress. Platini has been widely tipped as the new FIFA chief, but this long-held ambition is likely to be derailed if his suspension is not lifted and he's not cleared of all charges. FIFA has been mired in scandal since May when 14 FIFA officials were arrested in Zurich and charged in the United States with nearly 50 counts of corruption, including racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
They're playing back.
This evening, we take a look at a few of the basketball highlights from 2015. The defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors began the season in record-setting fashion. They won their first 24 games without a loss, the best start in league history. Right now, the Warriors, led by sharp shooting guard Stephen Curry, have a record of 27 wins and one loss, by far the best record in the NBA. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, I go back to June and give kudos to the Warriors for beating LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. Here's a sunny side of sports salute to the Golden State Warriors, who won their first National Basketball Association championship in 40 years. The Warriors scored a 105-97 road victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers to win the NBA Finals 4-2. League MVP Stephen Curry scored 25 points for the Warriors, a total matched by teammate Andre Iguodala. The 31-year-old Iguodala, whose father is Nigerian, was named the most valuable player of the NBA Finals. Golden State's head coach is Steve Kerr, who won 5 NBA titles as a player and now his first as a coach. Kerr began his post-game news conference with praise for the Cavaliers.
Congratulations to Cleveland, to Coach Blatt, who did a fantastic job. You think about the injuries they had, two of their top three players going down, and for them to have the season that they had and to get to the finals and to compete at the highest level and to have us on the ropes. It's an amazing job, and obviously LeBron is just an incredible player. So congrats to the Cavs. We were fortunate in a lot of ways this year. Maybe number one was health. To win a title, there's obviously a lot of work, but a lot of luck as well. And we had a lot of luck on our side this year, and our guys took advantage of it, and they were fantastic. But, man, what a night.
As Coach Kerr said, LeBron James is an incredible basketball player. He averaged almost 36 points, 13 rebounds, and 9 assists each game during the NBA Finals. But it was not enough for Cleveland to win its first NBA title. One of the key players for the Warriors in their title-clinching victory was forward Draymond Green, who had a team-high 11 rebounds and 10 assists. Green says the club's savior in the NBA Finals, though, was Andre Iguodala.
Andre is that guy that we all look to when everything going bad. I mean, whether it's him taking a backseat and letting Harrison start, you know, and not mumbling a word about coach's decision all year. And then coming in, he was great the entire series, not just when he started starting. He was great the entire series, but he saved this season for us. I always say Andre's a pro's pro. He's a professional guy, and it showed, and that's why he's the MVP of this series, and that's why we're champions.
That's Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, the 2015 NBA champions.
The Voice of America.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Now let's go to Juba, the capital of South Sudan, for another basketball highlight this year. It's where the inaugural Manute Bol Memorial Basketball Tournament was played. In another Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2015, let's listen in again to this report by Magumi Davis Wakaringe in Juba.
The theme of the Manute Bol tournament is Sports Unite Us. The event features South Sudan's 4 leading teams, Malakia Basketball, the National Engineering Sports Club, Black Stars Basketball Club, and Imla Talata Basketball Club. Nicola Bol is Manute Bol's cousin. He played on Sudan's national basketball team between 1968 and 1988. He says he hopes this inaugural sporting event in memory of his famous NBA player will give South Sudanese a brief respite from conflict.
We need our people to wipe their eyes from tears and to be happy for one day or two, for this whole week to be together. And we hope that this will make bridge among the, and we bridge the boundaries between the tribes and sectionalism and all things that divide us from each other.
Nicola Ball says the important life lessons take away from what happens on a basketball court.
If somebody aggresses you, you try to forgive him. And that is how it is. In basketball, if you get an elbow and you got an apology from your teammate or your colleague, you say sorry, no problem. We go ahead.
27-year-old Abraham Salva Mathok plays for the Black Stars. His team defeated Nimanatalata by a score of 60-45 in the first game of the tournament. But Mathok says there is more to the tournament than winning or losing a game of basketball.
This tournament is truly a positive thing, and it contributes to our nation's unity. So I'm actually proud to be a part of it, and it can actually contribute to our unity. Yeah, Manute Bol was a great man, and he's definitely done a lot for our people. So us as the youth coming together and doing something for Manute Bol to recognize his accomplishments is our small way of showing that this man is truly a great man.
Bol played in the NBA for 10 years, from 1985 to 1995. For the former Washington Bullets, now known as the Wizards, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Miami Heat, and the newly crowned NBA champions, the Golden State Warriors.
Nice one from Kellerman. Nice score from Kellerman.
Ayel Marwal Lake, who goes by the name Awilo, was chosen as the most valuable player for scoring 14 points for Nimanatalata. 25-year-old Lake says Manute Bol was the inspiration when he started playing basketball at age 12. Today he hopes to inspire other children to take up the sport and excel at it.
I wish every kid to enjoy basketball, to play, and we need South Sudan people in peace, people to come to the sport and play basketball, and we need to compete in every tournament in the world. For me, I wish, and I'll be working really hard to be best player in the world.
Robert Ladu Benjamin is chairman of the South Sudan Basketball Association. He says that 5 years after Bol died, at the age of 47, the 7'7" basketball star continues to inspire many South Sudanese.
So he's a symbol that person, whether from the town or countryside, could make it if he's determined.
Manute Bol is remembered not only for his skills on the basketball court, but also for the charitable work he did for the people of South Sudan. To acknowledge his contribution, USAID and other partners helped construct a basketball court in the remote village of Turarey, where Bol was born. Event organizers say they are already planning for future Manute Bol tournaments and will invite teams from neighboring countries and some of Bol's former NBA teammates to take part in them. VOA. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is Dikeme Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net. Thanks to Dikembe. Dikembe Mutombo also gets a sunny side of sports basketball highlight for 2015. In September, the Congolese giant was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a focus on migrant workers. And next, putting girls in charge of robotics competition in the U.S. But for some music, it is Danielle of Angola with Matumba.
Surra.
pelo postiço não decaiu, não sei pro que que insiste. Estilo do bem marado, mas até moça resiste. Boca, estilo, surra, cara enfeitada tipo elele. Chega na disco, gingona, todos fogem da negra bué. Lá vem ela. Tipo em bandeira. Desculpa menina se ofendo, mas é demais, não tem jeito. Dá-lhe, vai! Lá vem ela, a matumba. Bunda venha, bunda tunda. Corpo é corpo, é em bandeira. Não aguento, não tem jeito. Olha só o espaço que ocupa no carro da outra. Tipo candongueiro bem cheio na hora da conta. Nem racha um bumbo para abastecer na bomba.
Agarrada mulher
que chega bem rápido para cair na quizomba. Agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, que era quizomba. Agarra matumba, agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, que era quizomba. Agarra matumba. Fé do Rio de Janeiro, mas mesmo assim não tem jeito. Dente luta contra dente, que uso é de ferro. Galina dá licença, tenta chegar no sapato. Pois mudou o penteado, aterrou no afro marado. Lá vem ela,
a malaica,
candongueira,
a xaxeira.
Se te agarra, parte esqueleto. Desculpa menina se ofendo, mas o retrato é verdadeiro.
Que ela quer? Ela te quer? Que ela quer? Ela te quer? Vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero. Vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero. É melhor lhe dar pra me ensinar. Agora ou nunca. É melhor lhe dar pra me ensinar. Agora ou nunca.
Não vale a pena de que as malaicas de Nainita. Se ela não lhe quero, se ela lhe quero, ele não quero.
Tu ama tu.
Não vale a pena vir ofender. Você só se coça com quem quero. Ela te quero, você não quer.
Tunda, matumba.
Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Comprou no estrangeiro, mas continua matumba. Coça, coça. Ninguém aqui vai se atrapalhar. Daniel chegou para te animar. Mania fez esta batida. Que me cuia. Se não tem troma que é tua. Quem não dançou, manda ele em vida. Quem gostou, vai ficar. Vamos continuar até coçar. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce.
2005. Os matumbos tão tipo salalê na madeira.
Remix. Cuidado com este meu quiabo. Você me vê tirar voado. Fica maiado com este som. Bate frita tipo bacon. Nossa batida é muito chique. Tipo GT7 na SIC. Quer se matar?
Se mata.
Remexe a bunda. Sucesso.
Daniel of Angola with Matumba. A new study by the International Labour Organization finds that migrant workers account for more than 150 million of the estimated 232 million people who migrate every year to countries around the world. Lisha Schlein reports from the launch of the report at ILO headquarters in Geneva.
Migration and migrants are headline news these days, and not all the reports are flattering. The International Labour Organization says government policy debates regarding migration often are divisive and based on inaccurate information. Authors of the report say they hope to set the record straight by presenting reliable evidence on the true nature of migration. A just-issued ILO report is based on data from 176 countries and territories representing nearly 100% of the working age population, which includes those 15 years and older. The report finds a majority of migrant workers are men, but women account for 44%, a significant proportion of the working force. It says labor migration occurs in all regions of the world, but most people head for high-income countries in Northern America and Northern, Southern, and Western Europe in search of work. It adds more than one-third of all migrant workers are in the Arab states. The report focuses on migrants who are currently employed or unemployed and seeking work. It recognizes the problem of so-called irregular migration, but has no numbers, as such migrants live largely in the shadows of society and don't appear in national statistics. The ILO says the vast majority of migrant workers are in the services sectors, followed by industry, including manufacturing and construction. It finds 7.7% of all migrant workers are domestic workers, with 80% of them women. The report is putting a special focus on migrant domestic workers because it is one of the least regulated sectors of the economy. ILO Conditions of Work and Equality Department Director Manuela Tomei says domestic workers provide services in private households where they are exposed to labor exploitation and serious abuses.
In many countries, domestic work is not regarded as work, and therefore, irrespective of who is performing domestic work, national or migrants, that person does not benefit from, the protection of labor law, social security regimes, and all the machinery that ensures, compliance with the law.
The International Labour Organization says migrants need work, but many destination economies also need migrant workers, and this need will increase in the coming years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Despite making up half of the world's overall workforce, women hold only a quarter of the jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math. Educators call these subjects by their abbreviation the STEM subjects. A program in a high school in the United States is working to change that by putting girls in charge of a robotics competition. Erica Celeste reports from Perry Meridian High School in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Welcome to Cyber Blue. Like many high school robotics clubs, members work in a studio that's part machine shop, part dueling arena. While the 45-member club is composed of both genders, girls are operating the robots today. That's because they recently created and hosted Indy Rage, or Indianapolis Robotics All-Girls Event, a competition in which only girls were allowed to drive the robots. Male club members helped out in the pits, but girls, like senior Elizabeth Bremer, took the leadership positions.
We started this because we thought it was important that girls got into it. Not that they can't when boys are there, but some maybe feel like they can't step up when the guys are doing things.
Like many robotics competitions, the goal was for robots to pick up and deliver objects to a specific area to score points. Meanwhile, other robots tried to prevent scoring. Sophomore Olivia Shake was an operator for the girls' competition.
I felt a lot more stress taken off of me because I was with the girls and I felt like they weren't pressuring me as much as the guys.
CyberBlue first competed in an all-girls event last year in Michigan and did quite well.
Competitions are really fun for us because you get to see other teams' robots and you get to see how they do what they do, and then you kind of get ideas tracking back like, we could have done that.
Sophomore Raven Blakey, who was at the competition, thinks her team's success at the event may be one of the reasons the number of girls in CyberBlue doubled this year from 7 to 13. Lead mentor Chris Foltz, who works for Rolls-Royce as his day job, says the whole point of clubs like CyberBlue is to get students excited about science and engineering and thinking about careers in those industries. To help them toward that goal, students go through a rigorous process to join the team, from filling out applications to creating resumes and being interviewed.
We run like a small business, so the students apply to interviews, and every year they do that. So the students that are returning year after year also go through that process. So several students have told us that after the robotics interviews, their first job interview was a breeze.
Junior Katie Boyce says she wanted nothing to do with the robotics team when she first heard about it, until she realized that members joined sub-teams such as design, electronics, programming, or public relations.
My first year, I got here and I was like, oh, there's other stuff I can do. Like, it's not just about the robot.
Thanks to Cyber Blue, Katie now knows she wants to go into public relations, while Olivia wants to work on rocket engines for NASA. Raven might like to design cars, and Elizabeth is considering a career as an engineer. The girls will join their male counterparts for the regular robotics season the first week of January. If all goes well, Cyber Blue hopes to compete in the World Championships in St. Louis this spring. And maybe this time, girls will be at the controls again. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Indianapolis, Indiana.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 11th, armed rebels attacked two Burundian military camps and a military academy. This was the first coordinated assault on government installations by armed groups. In the initial attack and the aftermath, at least 87 people died in the most deadly day since the crisis began. Burundi may be on the verge of slipping into a civil war unless Burundians in the government and opposition eschew violence and commit to an inclusive dialogue. Last April, Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, decided to run for a third term in violation of the Arusha Agreement. His subsequent victory in an election deemed neither free nor fair by the international community triggered months of violence and an exodus of over 200,000 Burundians fearing a return to civil war. That conflict, which ended in 2005, cost some 300,000 lives. The underlying issues fueling the discord are poor governance, runaway corruption, and a flailing economy. Years of negotiations and power-sharing resolutions, such as the Arusha Agreement, meant to bridge the division between Burundi's two main ethnic groups, have been compromised. Rising militarization of both sides, a spate of targeted assassinations and incendiary rhetoric by high-ranking leaders on both sides, along with numerous incidents of human rights violations, threaten to tip the country into another protracted conflict. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski, said in a recent editorial that there are reports of human rights abuses committed under the auspices of government institutions that are specifically charged with preventing or stopping them. At the same time, opposition groups and armed elements are attacking government security forces and civilians. The United States condemns this violence in the strongest possible terms and calls on all sides to refrain immediately from violence. We support the efforts of the East African community, the African Union, and the United Nations to defuse the situation and urge the immediate start of high-level internationally mediated dialogue between the government of Burundi and opposition leaders in a neutral location. In the words of Assistant Secretary Tom Malinowski, we have a very small window left to restore rationality and reasonableness in place of the chaos and madness that is spreading throughout the country. We urge all parties to make the right choice before Burundi truly plunges into the abyss.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, romance. Is it important in sustaining a relationship? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing romance. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.